Welcome to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host, and today's show features Shamali Guttel, Executive Director of Focus on the Global South, a Thailand-based social justice think tank. Guttel was a part of a webinar on coronavirus, capitalism, and inequality hosted by London-based Global Justice Now on March 26th.
So, hello everyone. I'm joining you from my home in semi-rural area in southern India. And India is under complete lockdown till 15th April. And we really have no clarity what will happen after that. The rumors are that the lockdown will continue, but the lockdown is already having quite disastrous impacts, which I'll get to in a bit. I was going to talk a bit about structural adjustment and other issues, but you know, Nick's already talked about them, so I don't need to go there. But let me start by quoting Dr. Larry Brilliant. He's the very well-known epidemiologist who helped to eradicate smallpox. And he said in a BBC program several years ago that outbreaks are inevitable, pandemics are optional. And this was quoted again recently by Sonia Shah, a science journalist, in an article in The Nation in February, where she basically pointed to the complex impacts of the human footprint on ecologies and habitats, on urban expansion, the footprint of industrial agriculture, indiscriminate industrial activity, environmental pollution, and so on, in creating the conditions for pandemics to occur and flourish. And I will bring this up again. Nick has referred to them very well when he talked about structural adjustment, which is one of the, it was sort of setting, it's almost like chronicles of disasters foretold. And Heidi talked tremendously about the importance of having been prepared beforehand, which we weren't, because markets took precedence over people's health and people's rights. So we have actually created, in our generation, humanity created the conditions for pandemics to occur, not just once, but repeatedly. Now, the remarks I want to share with you are based on information, you know, from sources that I trust, from my own colleagues in Focus, what I'm seeing, who are people who are we are working with, and of course, analysts we work with. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic is, I think, truly novel, not only because of the novel coronavirus, but equally, more so, in fact, because of the context in which this pandemic is manifesting. We live in this extremely globalized world, where national economies and much of the world population's welfare depends on global supply chains that span the entire world, which in turn, of course, requires international travel and mobility, allowing the virus to spread exponentially. But fighting the virus and getting the materials to fight the pandemic also requires, unfortunately, that level of tapping into global supply chains, because countries have externalized very important functions and aspects of protecting the public interest. Now, the virus does not discriminate who it infects by class, race, gender, ethnicity. But the way things are now, class, social privilege, race, and ethnicity are important in determining who are most exposed and vulnerable to the virus, who experience the very worst impacts of the pandemic. And the worst impacts of the pandemic are not only infection, which of course is very important, but also the economic, social, and health impacts of the measures that the governments are taking. For example, lockdowns and curfews and so on. And I'll give you some examples of what's happening in Thailand and India and the Philippines and Cambodia. Now, this is true in Asia, but I think you'll also see this is happening among the working class and migrant populations in the north who are facing a brunt of lockdowns and curfews, which the middle classes and privileged classes in the north are not facing. Another very important aspect of the present context, of course, is this huge entrenched inequality within and across the countries. And Nick's already talked about them. Everybody's read the statistics. I'm sure all of you are very well versed with what's happening in terms of inequality. But what that means in practice, what does inequality mean in practice, is horrifyingly visible when we are hit by a crisis like COVID-19. Now, because of structural adjustment programs because of neoliberalism over the past four decades and this unbundling of manufacturing, food production, and services into global value and supply chains. Workers, peasants, artisanal fishers, herders, people in low-income brackets have become what we call the precariat. Much of what we consume in our daily lives comes from the precariat. Millions of people across the world are migrant workers in agriculture, in factories, in the hospitality industry, in construction industry, in domestic work, in public works that are essential to maintaining public hygiene. You know, so for example, public health, public works, public health depends not just on health services, but a number of other services, and I'll come to those. Now, these workers, whether they're in the construction or agriculture or whatever industry they're in, and peasants, they're poorly paid. They have little or no access to basic services and adequate food. They live in very cramped homes, slums, and shanties. Now, how can they practice social and physical distancing? How can they wash their hands several times a day when they don't have water? How can they not touch their face when they have no fans, when it's hot? They have no way of cleaning themselves. How can they wear masks? How can they follow the protocols that many health services have mandated? How is that even possible? Many workers are daily wage earners. They and their families eat if they earn that day. With the lockdowns that we have in many countries in Asia, how will people eat? Without adequate nutritious food, how will people build immunity to fight any virus? Now in India today, we have 4 million people. They're out in the open. They have no shelter, they have no food, they have no healthcare. Most of them are workers who are migrants from rural areas who have come to our massive teeming cities, you know, to work in the construction industry, for the wealthy, to build our houses, or they work in other service sectors, they clean the streets, they work as domestics. Many are seasonal labor, and they're all stranded, and there is no protection for them. Now, Nick already talked about how structural adjustment programs and neoliberalism has resulted in the gutting of public health systems, but also public services and goods in the South, of course, in the North as well. So hospitals have been privatized and governments have disinvested from public hospitals and health services. So they basically, with privatization, governments pulled back. They didn't have, for example, but particularly robust health system, but whatever it did have, whatever the people depended on, has also become much more precarious because the government over the last 2-3 decades has been disinvesting from any public services and public health systems. So as a result, not only low income, but even middle income and relatively wealthy countries, we across the world do not have the infrastructure to deal with a pandemic of these proportions. This includes trained medical staff, life-saving equipment, beds, hospital beds, testing facilities, systems for triage, research, monitoring, medicines, even masks and gloves. Now, this weak infrastructure, health infrastructure, is exacerbating respiratory and other virus-related health problems that among populations who have been exposed over long periods of time to environmental pollutions, toxins, and unsafe work conditions. I don't know, I'm sure all of you may have read over the last couple of years about the terrible air in Bangkok, in New Delhi, in Mumbai, in Bangalore, in Manila. Air quality index is so bad that people have developed chronic pulmonary respiratory lung conditions. The people, again, who are the worst affected, of course, are agricultural workers, workers in chemical plants, extractive industry, those who clean the sewages and other public areas. And basically, low-income communities and populations who live in the extremely polluted metropolis. Asia is supposed to be the engine of growth for the world. It was supposed to pull the world out of recession after the 2008-2009 economic crisis. And this engine of growth has come at a very, very high chronic health and safety cost for majority of the people there. So this again goes back to the point that Larry Brilliant said that pandemics are optional. It didn't have to be this way, but it is this way now. Now let's look at the responses of governments. Yes, this is a massive pandemic, et cetera. I mean, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not pretending that I know how to address the pandemic. But we do need to look at responses in terms of effectiveness, equality, justice, and human rights. Public health is related to many more factors than medical facilities. It's related to services, goods, rights, and justice. And here again, we see inequalities of impacts because we've seen time and time again in India, in the Philippines, in Thailand, in Cambodia, in Myanmar, across Asia, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, that natural calamities and pandemics hit the poorest and marginalized sectors the hardest. And it is these communities that are often ignored, discriminated against, and marginalized even further through government responses. I mean, basically, COVID-19 has exposed all the weaknesses of the public health system across the board. Our crowded and ill-equipped hospitals just can't accommodate the needs, especially of the poor during the health crisis. In Thailand, the government has actually been able to maintain a dual system. They maintained a very strong public health system as well as private hospitals, but even they are struggling. And if we look at India, for example, healthcare has been privatized since the 1990s, and the Indian government started disinvesting in healthcare about 20 years ago. Now, public government hospitals lost the financing they needed for equipment, training, materials, competitive salaries, other facilities, even committed doctors and personnel eventually left because they just weren't being paid. All small towns and cities we've had a sort of a mixed system. We've had general practitioners, you go to them for your small ailments and then they refer you to other bigger facilities for tests or specialized treatments. And of course, those who can afford it all have been going to private hospitals, which are very expensive. Insurance, there's a big insurance industry in India, but it's not health insurance, medical insurance. It's for hospital costs and it doesn't even cover medicines. But now with COVID, what's happened is that government hospitals have become the first centers of call. So it is these government hospitals, it's these facilities that have been disinvested in for the last 20 years, and that's where they're going. And we have news reports of doctors in municipal hospitals working shifts of 15 to 18 hours without sufficient protection. The numbers of patients can vary from 300 to 500 to even 1,000 a day, and they're handled by just a few doctors. Now, there are private hospitals. They could be called into service, but they're not being called into service. And when people ask why, basically the point is that in across Asia, what we're seeing, especially in India, Philippines, and Cambodia, that apart from lockdowns and curfews and closing borders, the strategy that the government has to address this pandemic, the strategy is simply just not clear. What we're seeing again and again in the times of crisis, how the rich and powerful flaunt privilege, the top political leaders in all the countries where we have programs, it's India, Philippines, Cambodia, Thailand, Myanmar, Laos, the rich and powerful and the political leadership all have direct and easy access to testing and treatment. But the state continues to deny mass testing because they say they don't have the kits. They can't even do triage. If you get sick, stay at home. But if you don't have a home, if you are stuck in a shanty town, if you are walking to your village, which is a two-day walk, where will you stay? So many of my colleagues and many of the social movements that we're working with are talking about how, we're back to the socialism for the rich and very brutal capitalism for the poor.
You're listening to Shamali Guttel, Executive Director of Focus on the Global South, from a webinar on coronavirus, capitalism, and inequality, hosted by London-based Global Justice Now on March 26th.
Now, when we look at the impacts of the crisis and the lockdown as a response to the COVID crisis, the crisis, when the government in India a few days ago, with 4 hours of notice, announced a 21-day lockdown and said, everybody off the streets, nobody gets anything, nobody steps out. One of the biggest issues that came up was that people are going to die of hunger before they're going to die of corona. And the virus is the flu virus. Young people, healthy people can survive it. People don't have to die of it, But of course, it needs to be checked. So the lockdowns and maintaining distance and doing everything that is possible to prevent the spread is important. But there also need to be measures in place that support those who are not able to survive these lockdowns. especially migrant workers, daily wage earners, people in the informal sector, indigenous peoples outside, rural peasants and fishers and so on. We look at food supplies. In the Philippines, for example, there is a group called LILAC, which is a solidarity group that works with indigenous women. They have been monitoring and working on the impacts of COVID-19 with indigenous people in the different areas across the Philippines. And the communities are pointing out that even before this health crisis came about, communities were already suffering, especially indigenous women and their families, because farmers and vegetable growers have been carrying the heaviest burdens of climate change and of all the extreme weather. They've had ruined harvests, they've had no water, their foods and income sources have been devastated. Many indigenous communities in the Philippines, but also in Cambodia, also in Thailand, also in India, also in Bangladesh, are victims of land grabbing by corporations and by governments to make way for, you know, large infrastructure, for mining, for industrialized plantations, for projects that, you know, basically treat natural resources as profitable commodities. When people protest, our areas get militarized. Militarization is rampant in all communities that are resisting this kind of industrialized development and so on. And so people leave their homes. People leave, indigenous people, but also other rural communities leave their ancestral homes. Either they have to leave or they end up being shot or killed by the military. They become migrant populations. And these are the people who come to our cities and our towns. These are the people who work as seasonal agricultural labor, whether it's in Thailand or in Myanmar or in Laos or in Cambodia and in India. And what we're seeing now is that the responses by the governments are not providing succor or support to them. They're bailing out construction companies, they're bailing out finance capital. There have been no congressional or parliamentary oversight on coronavirus emergency funding legislation. It's completely skewed towards corporate bailout packages, not providing any economic relief for the poorest of the poor or for daily wage workers. The economic stimulus packages do not actually say how the millions of people who are out of work and who are now sitting out in the sun and at night have no shelter, how they're going to be provided for. Frontline workers are risking their lives to provide healthcare, food, and other essential work, and they're taking the hardest hits. So there's no plan for them. We have to pull the world out of recession after COVID. But what happens now? In India, food that's grown by farmers, fish that's caused by fishers, it's rotting because the government has not made any provisions to collect this food and get it to markets and distribute it. We have food in India. We don't need to have hunger. We have food, but it needs to get to markets. It needs to be distributed. For that, the government needs to step up and provide safe conditions to get this food to markets, to get it to the people who need it most. They need to provide safe trucking facilities, storage, wages for transportation, adequate prices for producers, but they're not doing this. Instead, they ordered a 21-day lockdown and a four-hour notice with no support to hundreds of thousands of rural poor and the wage earners and migrant workers. Now, to talk about physical distancing, social distancing, you know, draw a circle around you, look after yourself. How are people going to do this? So, I mean, this brings me back again to the earlier point I was making, that public health is dependent not just on medical facilities. It depends tremendously on the kinds of conditions that we create, on the kinds of social conditions that we have, on the issue of social justice, access to other public services, and so on. Even curfew rules and punishments for those that violate quarantine, even those are being applied differently. There are those from the poor communities, if they're caught, they're beaten up in India or in the Philippines. They're put in cages. They're put in jails where they're cramped along with others. But, you know, politicians and rich people who violate quarantine, they get away with it. In fact, they're the ones who are spreading the virus even more often, more widely. But because there's no testing, we're not getting the information. We're not getting a proper map. We have no information. Migrant workers are really suffering in a way that is unimaginable. If we look at what's happened in Thailand, for example, or the areas in the Mekong region, more than 60,000 migrants are stuck at closed borders. There are approximately 3 million migrants from Myanmar, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam who've been rushing back they had to go back to their homes because there's no way they could stay in Thailand. But they have, many of them, the borders have closed. They have no way to go back. Workplaces have closed. They have no way to eat. They have no health care. They have no place to stay. They have no relief measures from their employers. And there's no clear communication about an emergency plan or relief measures from the governments. They also face negative impacts from very restrictive measures because many of them are undocumented. They don't have papers. So they face arrests and being locked up in places, where they're crammed together. They're not able to access key messages and updated announcements because they don't speak the local languages necessarily. None of the hotlines or, information that's supposed to go out to them reaches them. They're particularly also vulnerable because they are immediately identified as the outsiders, as the people who create the problems. They're facing tremendous amounts of racism and prejudice. And when we're talking of migrants, we also need to look at what's happening to people who are fleeing from conflicts, wars, and war under occupation. Just coming back to India there, I bring up the point, the example of Kashmir. Many of you have heard about what's happened in the northernmost state of Kashmir, which has been under the most brutal lockdown since last August. And it's already a state where social, medical, other economic services have been devastated. But increasingly now, they don't even have access to proper communication. Internet access, for example, has been even recognized by the Human Rights Council and even by the Indian Constitution as a basic right because so much communication, so much information comes through internet. Doctors can't get information about the latest protocols. They can't get testing. They can't get cases. They can't communicate out of the state. So the political situation and a pre-created lockdown situation in Kashmir, condition of occupation, a condition of war and conflict, has exacerbated and made, the population of Kashmir, they made them sitting ducks. Related to that, what we're seeing is a cementing of authoritarianism. In India, in Cambodia, in the Philippines, in Myanmar, basically emergency measures have been approved by governments. Colonial era pandemic laws have been reinforced. Emergency powers have been re-granted to governments without any oversight from any democratic bodies. And of course, in times of crisis, we know that human rights are the first systemic casualty because we hear government officials saying all the time that human rights must be suspended during a state of emergency, people don't listen and so on. And the thing is, people are so panicked that they're willing to let this go. They're willing to say, okay, we must listen to the government. We must listen to the government. We're willing to have the military in our streets. We're willing to have the police in our streets. But the reality is that governments don't have clear plans for combating the pandemic, for building trust with the public, and to win compliance for these severe measures and ensuring that those who are economically and socially vulnerable are actually looked after. They're not sharing full information about the natural situation because they don't have it and they don't want to admit they don't know. So instead, what they're using is defamation laws. They've added into the laws across Asia that anybody who criticizes what's happening, what the government measures are doing, can be arrested for spreading fake news, being anti-national, and so on.
Thank you very much. I think that was a really interesting insight into the way that this is playing out in Asia particularly. And also, I think that question of the authoritarianism, and I mean, I think we've seen even a little bit of that in the UK in terms of some of the quite draconian things that have ended up being passed in the bill that was passed before Parliament was closed early. We can see that there's a danger there. We want a progressive outcome, and people are starting to ask questions about problems of relying on the market and so on. But also authoritarians are also looking at this, and there's a danger we can go in that direction as well.
That was Shamali Guttel, Executive Director of Focus on the Global South, and James O'Nions from the London-based Global Justice Now. The entire webinar on coronavirus, capitalism, and inequality can be found on SoundCloud. You can find more from Global Justice Now at globaljustice.org.uk. You've been listening to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.